And hello, everybody, and welcome to the Global Forum. I'm Kelly. I have a great show for you today. I am featuring D-Day veteran Bob Sales. Robert Luther Bob Sales Sr. enlisted in the National Guard at the age of 15, gnawing his way into service. It was 1941, before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Sales served in the Army's Company B, 1116th Infantry Regiment, 29th Division. He told the news in advance in 2011 he was the only one out of 30 men in his landing craft to survive D-Day in 1944. This interview is from 2014. Sergeant Sales passed away in 2015. But this is a very special program because we are acknowledging June 6, 1944. Please enjoy this interview with that stupendous gentleman, Bob Sales.
Well, we're sitting here in the home of Bob Sales. Bob is, as most of you know, one of the great heroes of D-Day. And his actions on that day certainly were a story that, if you haven't heard all this, we certainly want you to hear it with us. Sergeant Sales on that day was awarded the Silver Star, the Purple Heart for his wounds, and he was the lone survivor of his landing craft. And what an amazing story that he will tell us. Sergeant, it's so good to see you. We're very glad that you are here today. Yeah, I bet you are, after that day. Take us back 70 years, and let's talk about what happened. Bring us in from the ocean.
Well, let's go back a little bit before that.
All right.
We were in the National Guard, who got inducted as just a regular army, and we were sent to Fort Meade, Maryland.
Well, now, wait a minute. You were you fudged a little bit on that. You were supposed to be a little older when you got in.
Yeah, but that didn't make a difference. I was just as tall as the rest of them. I was just a long, ranky country boy.
You were 15 years old.
Uh-huh.
So, all right, take us forward.
At Fort Meade, and then we went to Cape Blandin, Florida. We went all around training for a while. And this, I remember when we went up, we were inducted, there was a year ahead of the war,
mm-hmm.
of Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on our way back from maneuvers in North Carolina, going through Virginia here in a convoy, and we stopped for the night, and somebody come running up to the truck and said, Pearl Harbor's bombed. Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Most of us looked at one another because we didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. But there was one boy over there who had been in the Army before and had been over there. And he said, boys, you can forget about ever going home anytime soon. You got a war on your hands. And, of course, over the next hours, it developed, you know, what had happened. And we began more intensive training. Before we knew it, we were on the Queen Mary going to England. Not in a luxury line part, but 15,000 of us on there. And a lot of them were from Southside Virginia, you know, Roanoke, Lynchburg, Farmville, Danville. All those troops were on there. And a day off the coast of Scotland, you know, everybody was concerned about U-boats. And the British sent a cruiser out to sweep mines in case the Germans had laid any mines. And there's two ships in the ocean now, the Queen Mary and that cruiser. And the Queen Mary cut the cruiser in half.
Really?
And those 300 British soldiers died right in front of us. And half went down one side of the ship and half the other. And the next day, when we were taking off the Creamery, it was a hole in the bow big enough to put this house in. So we were very lucky. The ship went way over and come back up. And we were all up on deck because it was October, and the sun was warm, and it was crowded down in the below. If you wanted to eat, you had to wait in line. You could eat one time, go back and get in line. But we landed in England, and were immediately met by the British. Taken down to a place called Tidworth, about 24 hours of train ride. And we stayed there for a while, but the good times sort of, there was a lot of hard training, but there was a lot of good times. A lot of these boys were getting Dear John letters from home and kind of upset. They didn't have any trouble replacing those Dear John letters. All the British soldiers were in Africa fighting Rommel. And it was really a good time in England.
And that's what they said about the Yanks. You were oversexed, overpaid, and over here, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they said about you all?
Yeah, that's what they said.
when did you get liberty?
You got quite a bit. You know, at night you could go into the local town, but every once in a while you'd get a 3-day pass to London. Now, that was a good time. When you were an American soldier, had a little money in your pocket, and had a 3-day pass to London, you couldn't get any better than that.
Well, what was your first taste of English beer like?
We didn't make a difference, we just drank it.
It was all beer, wasn't it?
Mostly beer, very little. The bars would sometimes have a few bottles of whiskey, but they sold it out real fast. Most times just drink beer.
But training continued all the time.
Oh, yeah, but in the morning, you know, you might go out to see the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace in the morning.
Uh-huh.
But your afternoons and nights were filled with other things. The Covent Garden, the big opera house in London, covers about a city block. They converted it into a dance place. Because the British had to work 24 hours a day. They really struggled. And they started dancing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Every hour or two, they'd change bands. And I've seen as many as 200 women in the stag line. And some of these old country boys from Virginia see all those pretty girls, you know. And all you had to do was dance around real close to one. They would tap you, you know, you just work the crowd. Everybody had a good time.
Oh.
But there was plenty to see and do in London.
Now, how long were you there?
Oh, we were there probably a year, but we were always moving closer to the coast, a place called Slapton Sands. We would practice invasion landings and all. And it was just one thing after another. You know, have you ever heard of the Moors?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'd go up on the Moors sometime for training. And we went up there one time to test rations. And it was a good place to do it because there wasn't no way to get nothing but what they give you. It's just dry, wet grass, and it just gives under your feet. The only thing alive up there we ever seen was a few wild ponies.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept going, and the time kept passing. And finally, we were moved to a Marston area. And there was British guards guarding the whole compound. We couldn't get out or do nothing, you know. And this is where we were told what our part, just our part, of the invasion would be. And we seen aerial maps of those cliffs and bunkers that they had there, and you got to remember the Germans had been there 4 years, and they were well prepared for us, and they had anticipated us coming. So they, you know, we knew it was going to be tough. In fact, one officer said that he could take a machine gun and hold us off the beach, and he's almost mounted to that. So we After briefing there for 3 or 4 days, we were again told we go board a ship, and we were in combat gear, you know. We went on Weymouth, England. The ship's name was the Empire Joblin. It was a British ship. And we put out to sea, and I think the invasion was scheduled for the 5th, but the sea was rough, really rough storm. And it was postponed until the 6th. And we were on that boat for an extra 24 hours.
Did you get seasick?
No. All the seas I've been on, I never got seasick, and I sure am thankful for that. Because that's really a rough situation.
What happened then next?
We were on the ship, and when they finally said, we go tomorrow, that been June the 6th, everybody was up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it come time to go. I went around to see everybody I could from Lynchburg, and this kid one another, I'll see you on the beach, but I tell you, everybody was scared, but nobody was showing it. And then we had to go down rope ladders into the landing craft. And we had 6 boats, B Company had 6. And we kept, as they landed, got loaded, they circled the mothership. And at a certain time, we all stretched out and headed for the French coast. And we were 12 miles out. And that sea was rough. There was toss those landing craft around. One or two of them sunk. And we finally got close to the beach. I was the radio operator for the company commander. And I was right with him all the time. And he turned around to me, and he hadn't said a word the whole trip in. And he turned around to me and said, get up on the ledge and see what you can see. I crawled up there, and all I could see was smoke and fire and what looked like dead bodies. I dropped back down and told him, I said, dead bodies, I believe. He said, something wrong. And about that time, the British coxswain told us couldn't take us in any further, that he had to drop a ramp. And when he dropped the ramp, the captain was the first man off, and they hit him, and he fell in the water. And my friend Dick Wright was second off, and a medic was third, and I was fourth. When I went off, the boat ran up and kind of threw me sideways. I went off the side of the boat, and I had all that regular gear like everybody, but I had a 35-pound radio with me, and I had rehearsed in my mind what to do if this situation arose, and because I knew that radio would drown me. And when I got to the bottom, I had not buckled it, and I just peeled it off and left it right there. And I come up, and the captain was—he was up, and hollering, "I'm hit! I'm hit!" I started towards him, and when he went down, I went over there. When I got there, he was a short man, and he was in water over his head. When I got there, I could see blood boiling up from down underneath. So I said, "There's nothing to do for him. I got to save my own self here." And it took me—I looked back. And the rest of the men coming off the boat were just being cut down. It was just a slaughter. And the reason the Germans fortified that area, so there was only one road off the beach. It was all cliffs, and there was only one road going up to the town of Verville-sur-Mer, which was maybe a half a mile away. And they had barbed wire across that. I had bunkers, barbed wire, and that was the only road we had to get into tanks or trucks or anything up. And that's why they fortified it. So it was really a killing field there.
Did you land at the? Was it? Were you at the right place, or did?
Yeah,
you,
I landed the right place.
Yeah. So your landing craft was in the where it was supposed to be.
Yeah, we were zeroed in on that steeple of that church in Verville-sur-Mer, and we landed where we were supposed to.
Mm-hmm. So
that was the bad part, I think.
Yeah. Well, so what happened after this? Your officers were killed. and you're now off the boat. What happened?
I crawled in the sand, and when I got up there, my friend the sergeant, whose picture's on the wall up here, he wasn't dead, and he raised up on his elbows and said, "Help me." He evidently seen me, and he said, "Help me, help me." About that time, a sniper hit him in the head, and his face just dropped down the sand. And I just buried my face in the sand and waited for mine, because I knew he seen me too. See, this was a sniper. This wasn't a machine gun. This was a sniper who was there taking care of the ones the machine gun missed. And when they, I was just buried in it, just covered my head, knowing I was going to get it next. And that's when I realized I didn't know the 23rd Psalm. But I learned it right quick. And then after a while, I turned around, kept looking. I began to move a little. I thought maybe he had been found some other targets. And I looked around, and I could see other boats coming in. And one of them was close to us. And the ramp went down, and I seen a man come off to the end of it and get hit with a machine gun. His helmet flew off. And I knew then it was Dr. Ware, because he has flaming red hair. And he had brought himself in on the third wave rather than 4 o'clock that afternoon when the beach was clear.
And who was this?
Captain Robert Ware from Amherst, Virginia. He was a battalion doctor.
And he knew that he was needed there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had a bunch of men. He scattered them out. They went on different boats. But he brought himself in, and that was a mistake.
Wow.
Because he just fell in the water. But I remember that red hair for a long time.
Hmm. Well, you're on the beach, and things are just a mess. What happened next? What did you do?
There was a wall several hundred feet away, and I was trying to make it to that wall because it was protection. Now, the Air Force was supposed to bomb the beach, which would give us craters and stuff to get in, see, some protection. But they missed and bombed 2 miles in. Missed completely.
So you're crawling across the beach. It's basically flat. You've got people shooting at you from every direction. How did you make it to the wall? How were
crawling,
you the one?
Just crawling from one dead body to another, a log, anything, you know, that I could get any protection from. And when I finally got to the wall, I found a buddy of mine named Max Smith from West Virginia, and he'd been hit in the face. And it looked like his eye was partly hanging out. Now, I've got a lot of pictures of that. Somebody took a picture of it. He was standing up, and I slapped a bandage on his eye. And we started pulling dead out of the water, because a lot of men were killed in the water and boats sank and they drowned. We pulled a lot of men out of the water. Once in a while we'd find a live one. And the men on that right who continued to, see, some of our men got by pretty good. And they worked their way up the cliffs and got in behind those bunkers. And the Germans either got killed or they run. They didn't want to be captured. So the fighting was fierce all day long. But no, the officers were practically all dead. The second in command, Captain Williams, he was hit in the ear and he was evacuated. So we really didn't have any man. Now, I landed, I was a PFC. I had been a corporal, and missed a train back one time from London and got busted back to private. But I made up for it this day, because they called me in 2 weeks after invasion and said, "We're going to make you a sergeant." I said, "I want to be a staff sergeant." They said, "Staff sergeant it is." And I was promoted to staff sergeant right on the spot.
Good negotiating. That's great. Well, and because of the casualties and everything else, but also because of your heroism and bravery on that day, you were promoted to staff sergeant. That's pretty spectacular. Many soldiers go their whole career and never make it to staff sergeant.
Oh, yeah, but if you want to get promoted, you get yourself get in the infantry and get yourself a little war going.
A little war. Just a little war. Well, okay, so you made it to the wall, and things were perhaps a little better. At least you had a little cover. What happened then?
Well, I had nothing to fight with. I lost the rifle, everything. Of course, the radio wouldn't make a difference because there wasn't anybody to talk to. And I didn't have anything to fight with. So I pick up a rifle, and it won't fire because of the sand in it. And it was just one chaos after another. We were running into small bands of Germans, and they would run and would shoot a few of them or something. But our men, we kept losing men. That's where it got so bad. But by the night, they had sent a ramp launch in to pick up the wounded. And I was down the beach trying to get back on the boat. And the lieutenant who was in charge there from the hospital ship said, "You're not in shape to go back. You go on with them." So I was taken to the ship, the hospital ship, right out there a little ways. And the ship was going to England as soon as it was loaded with wounded. And after I got there, I found a bunk, and a doctor come around later. He gave me some pills, and I went to sleep. Next morning, I woke up, and the doctor here was. I said, "Doc, I got to go back. My company's in bad shape." He said, "We're going to England as soon as we get fill this boat up." I said, "I can't go with you. I got to go back." And he said, "Well, you go get killed if you go back." He said, "Stay till tomorrow, and I'll look at you again." So the next day, he come around next morning. I said, "How about it, Doc?" He said, "Well, you go on back in if you want to get yourself killed. But we're going to England. You could go with us." I said, "No, I don't need to go now." And I went up on deck, and they were bringing wounded from the beach in those launches. And there was a pile of stuff where all when you come on, you just left your rifle, your belt, pistol, everything, you just put in the pile. So I outfitted myself and got a ride on that launch back to the beach. And when I got to the beach, there was a recon outfit there for gas. And I said, "How about give me a ride? I got to find my company." And the next day, I found B Company. They had been pulled off the line to get new men and new equipment and get it organized. You know, everything was in terrible shape. Nobody know nothing. And I found B Company, and they thought I was killed with the rest of them on that boat. And they all come running out. Said, "We thought you was dead, man." I said, "No, not yet." And a few days later, we were committed back to the front. And, man, it was tough. Great. They had hedgerows. Germans on every hedgerow, and we had to go over the hedgerow to get him. Didn't have no tank support much because they couldn't operate in the tank and then around that terrain there.
Germans didn't want to give that country up, did they?
No. No, it was that country all the way to St. Lo. And we didn't get to St. Lo until middle of July. But once we got to St. Lo, there was flat country and then roads. Much better than the Normandy area there. It was terrible fighting in that country.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to see General Patton during that process? Because he was bringing his tanks in. And
no, I never did.
He wasn't.
But I saw him when we got up into Germany.
And what was that like?
It was real nice. One man from each company was sent back to see him. And he asked me, another one asked me, "How old are you?" He asked me where I was from and if I was getting enough to eat. And of course, all we had to eat was K rations, you know. And he asked me something else. He asked me, it was like funny. I asked him if I had warm clothes, and I told him, yeah, as good as we could get. And then at the end, he said, I'm going to give you 12 men, each 48 hours in Paris. And they took us off the line and give us clean uniforms and money if you wanted to draw it. But you needed cigarettes and soap. Stuff like that was far better than money. And to Paris we went. And when we got there, we decided to break up into two groups, six each. Because Paris hadn't been liberated too long and we didn't know exactly what to expect. But they welcomed us with open arms. And, you know, it wasn't nothing for a little boy to run up, pull you past. Yeah, yank, yank. Sister Virgin.
The oldest story.
You could walk into a cafe at 3 p.m, and for 6 of us, in a few minutes, 4 or 5 women would come down the steps. It's a very liberal country.
It was Paris, after all, wasn't it?
But we had a good time. I don't think we ever went to bed.
Okay. Liberty's over. Now back to the war. What did you do next?
Back to the war, back to the big battle, which was coming up for the Royal River. And it was to jump off on the 17th, which we did. And I had 35 men. And I was in reserve the first day, and the first platoon got cut to pieces. We had, our objective was a small town now called Cedric, but we had to cross an open field to get to it. And we just almost got slaughtered, the first platoon did. Because they had machine gun on a little high ground, and it was just a level beat field. And so we pulled back, got the dead out at the dock, and I curled up in a corner of the house, went to sleep, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, the captain's runner come down and said, he wants to see you. I said, man, this is bad news. And sure enough, it was. He said, I want you to take your platoon and get across that field before daylight. I said, Captain, don't you think they've got players? And he said, I hope not. I said, I do too. And we lined up and tried to go across that field and got pinned down. They opened up on us. And 4 or 5 men was killed, I know. And as soon as it got daylight, I knew where the machine gun was. As soon as it got daylight, I crawled back down a drain ditch to where the company commander was, and they had a couple tanks there, and the tanks were in case the Germans pulled a counterattack. And I said, if you give me one of those tanks, I'd knock that gun out. And they did give me the tank, but I made the mistake of taking them up the road, because the machine gun was right on the corner of the road in the field. And I figured it'd be easy to get from there, but run off a mine and blew the track off.
Uh-oh.
So I run back down there, and I said, you got to give me another tank. And the tank man said, I can't give you another tank. And I said, come here with me. And then I showed him that field out there, and men laying there just waiting to be shot. And he said, all right, but I'll give you another, but take it across the field. And we did. And we got up there where within range where the big gun on the tank could get him. And we threw 3 shells in the third one. I know we got him. And I hollered down to the tank crew, let's get out of here. And when it turned sideways, they had an anti-tank rocket, and they fired and hit right in the side of that tank. Blew me out of the tank. And I still can't understand why I wasn't killed, because that much explosion right there when I was standing, it killed him in the tank because it ricocheted through. And it blew me out of the tank, and I hit the ground, and balls of fire rolled out of my eyes, and I felt I had to roll away from the tank. I thought it would explode. So I rolled away from it. And then I felt warm blood, what I thought was blood, and I thought maybe half my head was taken off. I didn't know. I didn't know the way to find out. And in a little while, the men, when we knocked the machine gun out, my men attacked and took the town. But didn't do me no good. The medics come up and got me. And I couldn't see nothing. I was in bad shape. I was cut on my back and the one on the head, but neither one of those men did anything. It was shrapnel in both eyes. And they took me back to the aid station, and from there they put me in an ambulance and sent me back to a field hospital. And everywhere I went, they said, "We got nobody here that can handle your case. We'll send you back." And I ended up back in Liège, Belgium, all the way back there. And even there, at the big hospital, they said, "We can't do nothing for you. We'll get red tag you." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "That means you go to England on the first plane." They had old planes and took all the seats out where they hang stretchers around the walls. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Okay, let's go." I wanted to get back to England because I had a girlfriend there. But that's kind of crossed my mind. But I had not thought of anything of being blind. It looked like I was just so glad to get off that front alive that I was glad not, I didn't think of nothing else much. And I was there in a couple of days. They sent me out to the landing strip, and it was an old barrel factory where they had some men in, and that's where they load you on the plane. I was there for Thanksgiving. I remember I had Thanksgiving done, and I had to eat it with my hands. Wasn't no men out there. You wasn't supposed to be there. They drop you there and load you right on the plane. They had German prisoners working there. But they had a flight nurse. And when she was telling us people had where she wanted so-and-so, and she got to me, she made the big error of the word I didn't want to hear, was, I guess, putting it in the back of my mind. I want the blind sergeant in the back of the plane with me. That was the first American woman I'd heard for a long time. And I did get in the back with her, and she talked to him and said, "You won't stay in England now. You're going to the States." And that's exactly what happened. I ended up in England, which was a good hospital, really good. And it wasn't long until Christmas, and I was there for Christmas. But nobody could seem to do anything to me. I had too much shrapnel, and I had retina problems and all that. So they sent me back to the States after, at the hospital in England. At that time, you had to have a pass to travel, and my girlfriend couldn't get a pass. Her trip wasn't necessary, they said. So I never got to see her again. It was 50 years before I saw her again. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Anyway, they sent me back to the States to a place called Valley Forge. It was an Army hospital, and it dealt only in eyes and plastic surgery. And they sent me down from New York on a train, and when I got there, I just knew I was in a good place. I had three doctors looking after me. They assigned me a whack to take me in where I wanted to go, to PX and everything. See, I was fine physically, except that I couldn't see. I didn't have no other problems at all. And That whack was good to me. One morning, a couple of the other boys, they were all combat boys in there, blind and partially blind and everything. And they come in my room. And they said, "Sales, we got a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" They said, "Well, we're going to fix it." I said, "Fix what?" He said, "You got the ugliest whack on the ward. And we're going to change that." So I said, "All right, but I'm pretty well satisfied with what I got."
That's funny.
But, you know, I made a mistake. The company commander who went off that boat ahead of me lived in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, quite a few years after the war, his family come down here to see me. And they just were great. They was, if I'd have known them then, they would have been out there and really took care of me. But they, when they come down here, they offered me, they had a summer home in Atlantic City. And they said, "We'll let you have that home for a week, just everything furnished." They were quite rich people. And I never took them up. I should have. But if I had known them when I was in that hospital, I would have did pretty well. And I had another case that come up a little bit strange. The head nurse come around. I'd been there a while. And she said, "Everything going all right?" I said, "Yeah, pretty good." And she said, "I just want to make sure you nothing going wrong, anything, and we're going to take good care of you." I said, "Yeah, you're doing that." And she said, "Anything you want?" I said, "Well, you know, I was fighting that war over there for a good while, and I'd like to hear some music." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I keep hearing about this nightclub called the Latin Casino down in Philadelphia." She said, "Yeah, I've been there." I said, "I'd like to go." She said, "Well, you could go, but you'll have to go with a guide." Now, a guide, just a guy goes along with you and takes care of you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's just your eyes. So she, I'll look into that. And a couple of days later, old boy come around and said, "We're going to Atlantic, going to Philadelphia tomorrow." So I put on a clean uniform and medals and all. Off to Philadelphia we went. Got out 33 station and he said, "You stand right here. I got to go over here and see what time the train goes back." So I was standing there and a woman come up to me and said, "God bless you. Look what you've lost." And put something in my hand. And I said, "Thank you, ma'am." And she disappeared. A few minutes, the old guide come back, and he said, "We got to be back here at 10 o'clock. I said, "All right, what's this in my hand?" He says, $10, where'd you get it?" I said, "I don't know, but if you go on over and stand me out of the way, I can make enough to pay the damn blood bill here tonight."
That's great.
But we didn't have to pay the bill. There's a woman sitting there not far from us. She wanted to pay for the food. And that whiskey just flowed in.
I bet.
And a ringside seat, table.
That's great.
But the next, you know, at night, it was back to Philadelphia, back to Phoenixville in the hospital. And I stayed there for a year. I was in the hospital about a year and a half altogether, and I was there about a year. But I had one thing going there. The government had hired quite a few girls about my age at that time. And they were doing the last 6 months of training there. And the government paid them. And they were not army nurses. So you, a enlisted man couldn't go out with a nurse, an army nurse. They were lieutenants. But these young girls were wide open, you know. And we used to date a lot of them. Had a lot of good times with them. Once I got some sight back, you know.
Now, when did you get your sight back? How did that work?
I've been there for a while. not too long, and it got me some sight back, enough to travel around with.
Wow. And then you were, the Army muster you out from the hospital? Is that where you...
Yeah, I stayed at the hospital. They called me to a meeting one day, and after I'd been there a long time, and they said, three doctors were there, they worked on me, and they said, there's no point in us operating anymore, although we will if you want to go through it. But if you'd like, we'll give you a discharge and you can go home. I said, I'll take the discharge. And I did.
Wow. Now, you, since then, lots of things have happened. You've had a wonderful life. You've had a great career here in Amherst County. And just recently, though, you had a surprise from the French government. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was the French Legion of Honor. And the French president presented to six of us from all over. One from Virginia, I think, other than me. Anyway, when I got noticed that he was going to do it, and the time and date now in Washington, Arlington, I thought, well, maybe somebody will want to go with me. So I rented a limousine, 12-seat limousine, and I would begin to pass around. The first thing you know, I was way over. Everybody wanted to go. So I took six of my family and six friends of mine. And we just filled it up in no time, so I had to go rent one 18 pass. That cost me a right good penny.
Yeah, but you only go through this once in your
life. That's right, that's what I thought. So. I'm never going to do it again. And we went up there, you know, and the sheriff here found out about it. And I didn't know it. He was working through my wife. And a bunch of people from the church come down to see us all. And then the sheriff put out a led a procession, and he took us all the way through to Arlington. No stoplights. Nothing.
That's nice.
And each county we went through, we met the sheriff and all. They would come on board and talk to us and all.
That's great. That's great. Well, let's look back. 70 years ago, an incredible day, an incredible career, an incredible time. What sticks out in your mind, Bob, as you think about all this? What do you think back on?
Well, of course, D-Day, it was 2 days. The first day, D-Day, and the last day, when that shell got my eyes. So, we had 2 days to stand out.
Just amazing. Just amazing. You know, it's really quite the something when you listen to these veterans. And Robert Luther Bob Sells Sr., how he enlisted in the National Guard at the age of 15 and got away with it. Reminds me of a certain father I used to know. Yeah. I really can't say enough about the soldiers and the veterans. I can't thank you all enough for your service. And you know what? It doesn't matter if you served 1 year or 30 years, or even if you didn't make it past a boot camp. The point is, you enlisted. You enlisted to defend your country. Each and every individual who has enlisted deserves our respect. Do you know what it's like to enlist? Being a soldier, knowing what you're getting yourself in for? Knowing that you may die for your country? That takes courage. I'm a civilian. I don't have that kind of courage. I got people in my chat room. Verbalbite is a veteran. He's a hero in my eyes. He enlisted. It's unreal. Unreal. The spirit of the soldier. Look at them. And I said that even if you didn't make it past boot camp, well, some people didn't make it past being a shipped overseas. And that includes the great president in recent history, President Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, it was a lifelong job for him. He enlisted April 29th, 1937. He enlisted into the Army Reserves as a private assigned to Troop B, 322, 2nd Cavalry in Iowa. He was appointed 2nd in the Officers Reserve Corps of the Cavalry on May 25th, 1937. And on June 18th was assigned to the 323rd Cavalry. Reagan was on active duty for the first time on April 18th, 1942. Reagan had nearsightedness, so he was classified for limited service, so he could not go overseas. His first assignment was at the San Francisco Port of Embarkation at Fort Manson, California. He was a liaison officer at the Port and Transportation Office. It frustrated him immensely that he could not go overseas. He served his country honorably, all the same. I'm concentrating on the contributions of the American participants in World War II, D-Day in particular, as we celebrated the 74th anniversary yesterday, because it was getting really, really tough over there. We just couldn't seem to get Hitler out. He was invading. Poland had fallen. France had fallen. England was threatened. The Japanese, also part of the Axis. We were tired. Canadian troops as well. We were tired. Like, And we were dealing with the likes of Neville Chamberlain. And the Americans came in, prompted by the bombing at Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. I don't know how this war would have ended without the involvement of the United States. It had been going on for years. It started in 1939. Thank God the Americans entered the war in 1942 and helped us end this in 1944. You listen to what Bob Sales had to relate, what he endured on that day. My goodness. What a man. What a man. He enlisted in the National Guard at the age of 15. He lied his way into service. Like I said, reminds me of a dad I used to know and loved very much. It was 1941 before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. My father told my mother, "Don't worry, because he won't last a week." In other words, he'll get booted. He'll be back on the farm. Relax, Mom. But he lasted 5.5 years, and he won many decorations. He said, "I killed a lot of Germans, done a lot of things, but it had to be done." He landed in France on D-Day at the age of 18. And then fought his way across Western Europe. He died in 2015. He said, "Don't ever underestimate that word scared. Everybody was scared to death, but they were putting on a good front." Sales fought for another 6 months after D-Day. He was wounded in Germany. He was awarded 3 Purple Hearts and the Silver Star, among other medals. After the war, he worked as a land developer and pulpwood dealer, eventually retiring as owner of Sales and White Timber Company. He was one of 6 World War II veterans to be made a Knight of the Legion of Honor. He was a very staunch believer in being a proud veteran. He served in the Army's Company B, 116th Infantry Regiment, 29th Division. He was the only one out of 30 men in his landing craft to survive D-Day in 1944. He said he still thought of those he served with as young men having a good time in their youth. He had created a memorial at his home to remember the 113 members of B Company who died in the war. All these boys that were killed I remember as they were. I don't think of them as being an old man like I am. And they had fun when they could, when they were afforded the time to have fun. They loved Vera Lynn, and they loved all the other hits. One song in particular that they really enjoyed was a song called Candyman. And that was a pretty rockin' song for the 1940s. Oh my goodness. They'd get up and they'd dance and they'd do the Lindy. I have a song here I want to share with you. I want to thank Vorpalbyte for sending this to me. This is a fantastic rendition of Candyman by Christina Aguilera, and she does a great job with it. Was quite jazzed up a bit, but my goodness, Christina Aguilera does a fantastic job with that song. Can you imagine, dancing to that in the 1940s? Wouldn't that be quite the something? Well, they did. That was another highly popular song back then. But D-Day was hell. It was really hard. World War II, from 1939 to 1945. The Battle of Normandy, which lasted from June 1944 to August of 1944, resulted in the Allied liberation of Western Europe from Nazi Germany's control. Codenamed Operation Overlord, the battle began on June 6, 1944, also known as D-Day, when some 156,000 American, British, and Canadian forces landed on five beaches along a 50-mile stretch of the heavily fortified coast of France's Normandy region. The invasion was one of the largest amphibious military assaults in history and required extensive planning. Prior to D-Day, the Allies conducted a large-scale deception campaign designed to mislead the Germans about the intended invasion target. By late August of 1944, all of northern France had been liberated, and by the following spring, the Allies had defeated the Germans. The Normandy landings had been called the beginning of the end of war in Europe. After World War II began, Germany invaded and occupied northwestern France beginning in May of 1940. The Americans entered the war in December of 1941, and by 1942, they and the British, who had been evacuated from the beaches of Dunkirk in May of 1940 after being cut off by the Germans in the Battle of France, were considering the possibility of a major Allied invasion across the English Channel. The following year, Allied plans for a cross-channel invasion began to ramp up. In November of 1943, Adolf Hitler, who was aware of the threat of an invasion along France's northern coast, put Erwin Rommel in charge of spearheading defense operations in the region. Even though the Germans did not know exactly where the Allies would strike, Hitler charged Rommel with finishing the Atlantic Wall, a 2,400-mile fortification of bunkers, landmines, and beach and water obstacles. And I just want to make a correction. Earlier, I said that the United States entered the war in 1942. Nope. They entered the war in 1941. So my apologies. Well, in January of 1944, General Dwight Eisenhower was appointed commander of Operation Overlord. In the months and weeks before D-Day, the Allies carried out a massive deception operation intended to make the Germans think the main invasion target was Pas-de-Calais. That is the narrowest point between Britain and France, rather than Normandy. In addition, they led the Germans to believe that Norway and other locations were also potential invasion targets. Many tactics were used to carry out the deception, including fake equipment. A phantom army commanded by George Patton and supposedly based in England, across from Calais. Double agents and fraudulent radio transmissions. Now, what happened? Eisenhower had selected June 5th, 1944 as the date for the invasion. However, bad weather on the days leading up to the operation caused it to be delayed for 24 hours. On the morning of June 5th, after his meteorologist predicted improved conditions for the following day, Eisenhower gave the go-ahead for Operation Overlord. He told the troops, "You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, towards which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you." Later that day, more than 5,000 ships and landing craft carrying troops and supplies left England for the trip across the channel to France, while more than 11,000 aircraft were mobilized to provide air cover and support for the invasion. By dawn on June 6th, thousands of paratroopers and glider troops were already on the ground behind enemy lines, securing bridges and exit roads. The amphibious invasion began at 6:30 a.m. The British and Canadians overcame light opposition to capture beaches codenamed Gold, Juno, and Sword, as did the Americans at Utah Beach. U.S. forces faced heavy resistance at Omaha Beach, where there were over 2,000 American casualties. However, by day's end, approximately 156,000 Allied troops had successfully stormed Normandy's beaches. According to some estimates, more than 4,000 Allied troops lost their lives in the D-Day invasion, with thousands more wounded or missing. Less than a week later, on June 11th, the beaches were fully secured and over 326,000 troops, more than 50,000 vehicles, and some 100,000 tons of equipment had landed at Normandy. For their part, the Germans suffered from confusion in the ranks and the absence of celebrated commander Rommel, who was away on leave. At first, Hitler, believing the invasion was a feint designed to distract the Germans from a coming attack north of the Seine River, refused to release nearby divisions to join the counterattack. Reinforcements had to be called from further afield, causing delays. He also hesitated in calling for armored divisions to help in the defense. Moreover, the Germans were hampered by effective Allied air support, which took out many key bridges and forced the Germans to take long detours, as well as efficient Allied naval support, which helped protect advancing Allied troops. In the ensuing weeks, the Allies fought their way across the Normandy countryside in the face of determined German resistance, as well as a dense landscape of marshes and hedgerows. By the end of June, the Allies had seized the vital port of Cherbourg, landed approximately 850,000 men and 150,000 vehicles in Normandy, and were poised to continue their march across France. By the end of August of 1944, the Allies had reached the Seine River. Paris was liberated, and the Germans had been removed from northwestern France, effectively concluding the Battle of Normandy. the Allied forces then prepared to enter Germany, where they would meet up with Soviet troops moving in from the east. The Normandy invasion began to turn the tide against the Nazis. A significant psychological blow. It also prevented Hitler from sending troops from France to build up his Eastern Front against the advancing Soviets. The following spring, on May 8, 1945, the Allies formally accepted the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany. Hitler had committed suicide a week earlier, on April 30th. These great men It's amazing. You know, it's hard to believe the spirit of the human being and the determination to secure our freedoms. Can you imagine being on those beaches that day? This is what it sounded like. This was incessant. It was horrifying to hear. And like Bob Sales said, don't underestimate being scared, because it was scary. Just listen. This is actual audio from the landing. Imagine listening to that for hours and hours and hours on end. And seeing bloodshed around you, your comrades being shot in the head, right beside you. The sights, the sounds, the smells. I cannot even imagine myself. Being a soldier is a calling. Vorpalbite in my chat room is a veteran. This is what he was willing to engage in order to ensure the freedoms that we take advantage of today. And we're not doing a great job of remembering and honoring the memories of our fathers, our grandfathers, our uncles, and back then, the women behind the scenes. We are still at war. World War II was a war that fought back tyranny and won. wonderful men on those beaches. Listening to that interview. With D-Day veteran Bob Sales. Talk about that day. We have very few who could even stomach what those men endured. But we have to find resolve. And we have to ensure that we continue to carry the torch for freedom and keep tyranny at bay or kill it altogether. There are new threats and they're beyond just being on the horizon. They're right here. They have crossed the horizon and it's right in our midst. And it is an enemy that is determined to conquer us. We dealt with Hitler and the Nazis. We prevailed. Now it is time for us to pick up arms and defend ourselves again against the invasion of Islam. I want to thank you guys for being here. I really do enjoy being, doing these shows. And I'm very grateful to Global Patriot Radio allowing me to do so. Because I need a forum. I need a forum to share with you. And your support of Bigfoot. Bringing it, boy, Gary Comfort, Vorpal Bite. All of you out there. Today is Thursday. Tomorrow, on the Global Patriot Radio, you have Dr. Carl Goldberg, The Logic of Islam. On Saturday, Usama Dakdok and Christy Johnston, Revealing the Truth about Islam. On Sunday, Eric Kafir, Radio Free Kafiristan. On Monday, Al and Fido Esposito, Mama Mia, No Sharia. On Tuesday, you have me, I'm Cal Fritzi, of Infidels Are Watching. On Wednesday, you have Paul Sotliff, Civilization Jihad Awareness. And Paul had a great show last night. If you missed it, please listen to it. Paul will be moving his show to Thursday as of June 28th. So, the Global Forum is going to move to Wednesday. Unless by then we have a new radio host. And we might have one. We might have a new radio host. That's going to be fantastic if this pans out. I very much enjoyed bringing you these programs. You know, this program is designed to enlighten and connect you with the best and brightest minds within the Counter Jihad movement. And each week, I have been featuring a person of influence or a person you've never heard of. It has allowed us to share discussions, interviews, and lectures pertaining to the issues of Islam. We just want you to be part of the conversation. And on that note, I am going to close out in honor of the soldiers from the past and to the present, to the veterans. This is Franklin Delano Roosevelt's D-Day prayer. Thank you all so very much for joining the Global Forum.
My fellow Americans, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces, but we shall return again and again. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom as we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent. Let words of prayer be on our lips. Give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done.
Almighty God. Amen.